This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Wild Sign, an Alpha and Omega novel by Patricia Briggs. Read for you by Holter Graham. For Colin, Amanda, and Jordan. Here's two less interesting times. Prelude. Summer, Northern California. Sissy Connors, PhD, checked her GPS, adjusted her backpack, and continued her trek into the mountains. Common sense told her there must have been an easier way, but none of the trails on the USGS map seemed to go exactly where she needed to travel. She was an experienced hiker. Her doctorate was in botany, and her field study trips sent her to the edges of the world, looking for oddball plants that might contain the cure for Ebola or MRSA or some other disease. Elvis, her half-German shepherd, half-who-knows-what, except it was big, who trotted beside her, was experienced, too. Generally, he would trot back and forth, investigating anything he found interesting, then checking in with her, before exploring again. But for the last 5 miles, he'd stuck to her side like glue. He didn't look nervous, precisely, but the last time he'd done this, it had been because a cougar had been stalking them. This was cougar territory. Elvis's attitude had her paying attention to the branches of the trees she was walking under. But other than some porcupine sign, she hadn't found any indication she and Elvis weren't the only living things for miles. She didn't think it was a cougar making her dog cling to her side because she felt it, too. The air was different. In her years of wanderings, she'd explored places that were sacred, where every step forward felt like a sacrilege. She'd discovered secret meadows or caves that welcomed her presence. She'd hiked through places that made her stomach turn, even though her normal senses found nothing wrong. This had all the hallmarks of one of those hikes. She found some comfort in trailing her fingers in the big dog's rough as they climbed. It was hot, and the last few miles had been uphill. She stopped in a shaded place, took out a canvas water bowl, and filled it from her canteen. She set it down for her dog and took a good swig herself. She was near her goal. She'd been circling it for a while, trying to find a negotiable path through the mountainside. "Dad," she told the empty air, "I know you like to be an off-grid hermit, but this is ridiculous." She found it an hour later, 15 minutes after she swore she was going to turn around and start the 2-day hike back to her car. She passed the rock face of yet another cliff and stopped. A petroglyph. Tired, sweaty, and frustrated as she was, she couldn't help the smile of wonder. She reached out, but did not touch it. The marks were perhaps 2 feet square, and they formed a symbol she hadn't seen before. Like the legs of an isosceles triangle, 2 lines rose from opposite edges of the petroglyph and met with their vertex angle at the top of the figure. Each of those legs was crossed by 3 upward slashes. She took a step nearer and realized there was a steep trail up the side of the cliff, tucked into a crack in the rock she hadn't been able to see from where she'd been standing. There was no sign it was a trail to her father's camp, but it headed in the right direction. She crawled up the steep trail, helping Elvis up ahead of her with a hand on his rump when he couldn't find purchase on the sheer rock. It wasn't quite steep enough for her to use her climbing gear. She had to crawl out through a hole between a tree and a rock the size of a small house to get to the top. If the thought of getting Elvis back down in one piece hadn't been so harrowing, she might have given up. She hoped she could find another way back once they were at the top. Finally, she surmounted a particularly difficult bit and found herself in a small meadow surrounded by dense forest. They had tucked the buildings in under the forest canopy so well, it took her a moment to see she had reached her goal. But once she noticed the first building, her eyes started to pick out the rest of them. There were a few tents, but most of the living spaces were actual cabins or yurts. It was more than an encampment, a whole town, really, complete with one tidy cabin marked by a small hand-painted sign that read USPS Wild Sign. It was much more civilized than she had expected her dad to tolerate. It took her a minute to realize it was too quiet. "Hey," she called. "Dad?" She waited. Then she tried. "Dr. Connors? It's your daughter. Also Dr. Connors?" But only the wind answered. Summer, Missoula, Montana, previous to the events in Burn Bright. "I am never going shopping again," Rachel said solemnly before tossing back the whiskey shot she'd requested from their server. She was a small woman with curly brown hair and a rounded build. She'd managed somehow to escape the hyper-fit look most of the werewolves acquired. Anna had thought Rachel had ordered the whiskey because that was what Leia had ordered. But watching Rachel put the liquor away made Anna reconsider. Anna sipped at her own drink without enthusiasm. She should have ordered whiskey too. Specialty cocktail or not, her drink tasted like paint thinner. Doubtless the high alcohol content was supposed to make up for the taste, but as a werewolf, Anna didn't even get much of a buzz from it. If she had been in this little intimate back room of the restaurant with her mate, she'd have laughed, put it aside, and ordered something else. But she was in, if not precisely the company of enemies, then certainly dangerous company. It was important to maintain the appearance of competence. Competent people, she was sure, did not order drinks they did not like just to impress people with their non-existent sophistication. Rachel set her glass down and told it, "No more fitting rooms for me." Anna grunted in sympathy. "That," said Sage, accusingly, tipping her glass toward Anna, "was a Charlie grunt. No men allowed on this expedition means no grunts." Model beautiful Sage was the only person allowed to call Anna's mate Charlie, not excepting Anna herself. Sage treated him like a big brother, and, Anna thought ruefully, Charles treated Sage as if she were any other member of his father's pack, to be protected, but also to be held at a distance. Only with his brother and his father did the impassive shield he kept around himself loosen. With Anna, he had no shield. Charles belonged to Anna with all his complicated soul and uncomplicated heart. Anna would much rather be curled up with him in front of the fire or eating something one or the other of them had cooked. Instead, she sipped at her paint thinner at a restaurant in Missoula, the better part of 200 miles away from home, at the tail end of one of Leia's females-only shopping expeditions. Anna was pretty sure there was no clothing store, shoe store, or makeup counter in Missoula they had not explored. Anna's feet ached, and she saw Rachel slide out of her shoes and flex her toes when she thought no one was looking. Even Sage, the shopping queen, was rubbing her left calf. Only Leia, in 4-inch heels, looked perfectly comfortable. Anna frowned at Leia's feet. Maybe Leia wasn't crazy for spending ungodly amounts of money on her shoes. Leia, the Marok's mate, used the shopping trips to Missoula or Kalispell as bonding time for the women in the Marok's pack. Usually, they were something anyone without a Y chromosome could attend, but this time, Leia had limited it further. Anna, Sage, Leia, and Rachel. Anna was pretty sure the trip had been designed to get Rachel, who had come into the pack only a month ago, comfortable enough to open up. Rachel was not a permanent pack member. She would be with them only until the Marok found a place for her that he liked, somewhere safe. As Anna well knew, even werewolf strength didn't help you when your abusers were werewolves too. Rachel had come to them after her pack had undergone an extensive reorganization. No one had been killed, but her old pack was under new management. The former Alpha moved to a different pack where he was not in charge. Outside of the Alpha, Rachel had been the only wolf extracted from the situation. Rachel hadn't said a word above a whisper since she'd arrived 2 weeks ago, and Leia and the Marok, or both, had decided to do something about that. Shopping. Anna smiled into her house special cocktail as she pretended to sip. After 2 hours of trying on clothing, Rachel had forgotten to be intimidated and had joined the chorus of moans when Sage had found a dress that made her look fat. Tall and slender, with gold-streaked brown hair and deep blue eyes, Sage looked more like a fashion model than most of the fashion models. Finding something that made her look bad had been quite an achievement. Distraction and bonding over bad fashion had broken through the shell Rachel had worn and revealed a quiet but naturally cheery soul. Leia, for all of her faults, was good at her job, and the semi-good-natured ongoing rivalry between Leia and Sage that Anna was convinced they both enjoyed served as a reminder that no one in this pack needed to worry a more dominant wolf would overreact to a little snark. A reminder that the Marok's pack was safe. Anna had probably been included because she was an Omega wolf. Without trying, she pulled the tension in the air down to a manageable level and made people feel comfortable around her. This wouldn't be the first time she'd been recruited to help with a damaged werewolf. Now that Rachel was talking, Bran would be able to figure out where she would fit in best, whether that was in the Marok's pack or somewhere with less potential for violence. Most of Bran's pack were there because a lesser alpha would not be able to control them. Food came eventually, and in the middle of eating her steak, Rachel broke into the conversation with a total non sequitur. "I feel like a failure." Sage reached out and covered her hand. "Why is that?" "I'm a werewolf," she told Sage, "and I had to run away from my problems because I couldn't protect myself." "Me too," said Sage promptly. Rachel's eyebrows shot up, and her mouth opened in surprise. Anna had noticed throughout the day that Rachel was sporting a case of hero worship for Sage. Anna understood that. Sage had been the first to welcome Anna to the pack, too. Sage made it a point to protect newcomers until they could stand on their own 2 or 4 feet. She was an effective protector. Her reputation as a fighter left most of the pack unwilling to push her too far. Privately, Anna thought the way Sage called Charles Charlie also helped her in her efforts to cow bullies. Most of the wolves in the pack were a little afraid of Anna's mate. None of them would have dared to give Charles a nickname he disliked. Sage nodded at Rachel. "One wolf cannot stand her ground against a whole pack." She cast a mischievous look at Anna. "Wolves whose last names are Cornick accepted." She returned her attention to Rachel. "Even Charlie had to bring Asiel along to straighten out the mess your old alpha made of his pack, Rachel." That wasn't why Asiel had gone. Asiel had been sent so there would be no chance of any defiance that would force Charles to kill someone who might otherwise be saved. Charles alone was terrifying. Asiel was a legend. No normal wolf would even imagine disobeying the pair of them. Sage nudged Anna's leg underneath the table. At least she thought it was Sage. It might have been Leia. Anna was supposed to share her story to make Rachel feel less alone. "Oh, goody." "Me too," Anna muttered unenthusiastically. "I spent my time in purgatory."
"But you're an Omega," exclaimed Rachel. "No one would abuse an Omega wolf."
Anna would have let that stand, but Sage said, "They did. They forced the change on her and followed up with several years of rape, pimping out, and beating." Anna pushed her plate aside, because she wasn't going to be able to eat after that.
"Yes," she said. "And I needed rescuing too, Rachel. But this isn't a my life was worse than your life contest."
Trying to avoid seeing Rachel's expression, Anna met Sage's eyes accidentally. The other wolf immediately dropped Anna's gaze, and there was a faint flush on Sage's high cheekbones. Did Sage feel like it was a contest? Anna grimaced.
"Is that what life as a female werewolf is?"
asked Rachel, in a subdued voice.
Abuse? Looking for a protector, a rescue?
Rachel was tiny, maybe 2 inches shorter than Anna. Next to Sage and Leia, who were both very tall women, Rachel looked fragile and defenseless.
Remember what pack you were in, Anna told her. There are hundreds of female werewolves out there, and the Merrick only brings in 1 or 2 women a year who need assistance.
Don't forget, werewolves can live a long time, said Sage,
pulling Anna's uneaten dinner over and shoving her clean plate in front of Anna.
We all, male and female, are likely to run into a bad alpha or some other kind of abusive situation at some point. The trick is to not join the other side of the equation and become abusers ourselves.
Leia pushed her own empty plate aside and downed her 4th shot of whiskey neat.
I think it's a matter of choosing your mate well.
Sometimes the older wolves showed the effects of being raised in an earlier era, like Leia's assumption a good mate was the cure for all problems. Anna was pretty sure no one else at the table believed the cold relationship Bran and Leia had was a good thing. It wasn't abusive. Not quite. Not physically abusive, anyway. But Anna would have lasted a month tops in a relationship where her needs were met with attentive care and not an ounce of affection. But no one could say that, of course. Though there was something in Leia's face that made Anna wonder if Leia knew what they were all thinking.
How did you choose Bran? Asked Sage.
Anna had presumed Sage, at least, would have known this story. There were a lot of things that everyone knew except Anna, and she'd assumed the details of Leia and Bran's courtship had been one of those. Anna knew better than to go around asking questions about the older wolves' pasts. If they wanted you to know, they would tell you. All Anna knew about how Leia and Bran met was that Bran had gone off to find a mate and had come back with Leia. Leia played with her napkin, making her newly polished nails glitter in the deliberately dim lighting. She glanced around, as if looking for witnesses, but she had reserved a private room for them, and the other 2 tables in the room were empty. The door was shut, and there was no sign of waitstaff.
I don't talk about it, she said shortly, in a tone of voice designed to put an end to the topic.
Sage was made of sterner stuff. She huffed a laugh.
I understand that, darling, else I would know the story already. But now you've got to tell us. How did you get messed up with...
Leia raised an elegant eyebrow, and Sage grinned and altered her wording mid-sentence.
How did you meet our fearless leader?
For a moment, Anna thought Leia would balk. But finally she said,
My father and mother were missionaries, called by God to educate the heathen savages.
She took up her unused salad fork and peered at it, as if looking at her own reflection. A lot of the old wolves still took for granted things Anna's generation tended to give more careful evaluation. Even so, Anna would never have thought the Leia she knew would have been able to utter such a sentiment seriously. But if there was sarcasm intended, Anna couldn't pick it up in Leia's voice.
I was 15, the oldest of 6 children, Leia continued.
What Leia said certainly had the ring of truth, but her casual tone hid more mass than the visible top of an iceberg did.
And Papa packed us all up in a wagon and headed west.
This was when? Asked Anna.
She might not know Leia's story, but she knew her husband's history. He'd been a child when Bran brought back Leia.
Late 1820s or early 1830s?
History had not been her best subject. The living in a pack of wolves that encompassed individuals born before the Mayflower left port had upped her game. Leia's father's expedition west seemed pretty early. The Civil War and the California Gold Rush were both in the middle of the 19th century. The western expansion had mostly been driven by those 2 events. Leia shrugged.
Maybe. I don't remember. Our church funded us to fuel the salvation of pagan souls.
There was the thread of cynicism Anna had felt, but not really heard.
Papa packed us all in a wagon, except for my littlest brother, who was only a few months old. He stayed with my aunt and her family. The idea was we would get settled, and then my aunt and uncle would come join us. She huffed an unamused laugh, and her foot began to tap a rhythm on the tile floor. He had no idea what he was doing, my papa. Big dreams and no common sense. We ran out of food first, then my little brother James broke his leg and died from the infection that set in.
She was speaking in a quick, light monotone, as if she couldn't bear to actually think about the words she was using.
2 days later, one of our horses went dead lame, and the other couldn't pull the wagon on his own over rough ground. For lack of any other plans, we camped next to a creek for a week or so, waiting to see if the lamed horse would recover before we all died. The horses were pets, and Papa couldn't bear to shoot one of them just to feed us. He couldn't fish, and Ma spent her time crying. But my oldest little brother Tally and I caught a few trout. Not enough, though. We were starving to death when he came.
The door behind them opened, and a waiter came in to bust their plates. Leia pasted a polite smile on her face and ordered another whiskey in a voice slightly too loud. Hesitantly, Rachel ordered red wine. As Sage requested water, Leia started humming under her breath. Anna asked for water too, but most of her attention was on Leia's music. Her humming was spot on for pitch, and rich enough to hint Leia might have a beautiful voice when she sang. Anna had never heard Leia sing. In the Marrocks pack, music was everywhere. Anna had assumed Leia just didn't have a good voice, that she couldn't sing. Not that she didn't sing. The door shut, and they were alone again. No one said anything, unwilling for Leia to stop. The tune she hummed was compelling in the way Bohemian Rhapsody, Stairway to Heaven, or In the Hall of the Mountain King was compelling. Anna found that she leaned forward to hear more, and tapped her own foot in time with Leia's foot, which was giving a percussive beat that was counter to the rhythm of the song. Sage's eyes were wide, and she was staring at Leia. Sitting beside her, Anna could scent her unease, fear, even. It was Rachel, not Sage, who broke the odd spell, though.
"What are you singing?" Rachel whispered. "I think I've heard it before, but I don't remember where."
Leia stopped, blinking rapidly, as if she'd been caught up in the music, too.
"Where is that whiskey?"
she muttered. Then she shook her head and lied.
"Nothing, Rachel. It's just a song I heard once upon a time."
She seemed to hear the lie with a little surprise as it crossed her lips, but she didn't correct it, just shrugged and said briskly,
"Anyway, Bran showed up. They saved me by changing me into a werewolf."
That was weird. Changing someone was not a way to save someone who was starving. And who was they? Charles had told her Bran had gone off alone and brought Leia back. Anna knew better than to ask about any of that, though. Leia hated Charles, and that put a few odd kinks in her relations with Anna, Omega or not. If Anna questioned Leia about a situation she clearly did not want to speak about, Leia would clam up.
"You were 15?
Asked Sage, an edge of outrage in her voice, because, like Anna, she had been born in the last 100 years.
15? When he took you for his mate?
It was a good question, but it wasn't the first on Anna's list, her very long list. And she was pretty sure it was wrong, too. Someone, Charles, surely, would have told Anna if Leia had been only 15 when Bran brought her back to his home in Montana. Leia shook her head and said briskly,
15? Goodness, no, 20 or more, I think. You know how time blurs after a while.
The he who had come upon Leia and her starving family had not been Bran then. 5 years or more between that day and when Bran had rescued her by transforming her into a werewolf. Leia had given them only the beginning and the end, leaving out all the interesting parts in between. Why had she started the story if she wasn't going to finish it?
Anna waited for Sage to address some of those questions, but evidently she decided to leave off questioning. There was a long, quiet pause as Rachel finished her drink. Sage fixed her makeup, and Leia stared at her empty shot glass. Anna tried not to look like she was bursting with curiosity. 5 years of something so important, Leia wouldn't talk about it. Anna would bug Charles. She took out her phone and texted him. Almost done. Do you know how and why Bran changed Leia? She'd been texting him on and off all day. She'd sent him a photo of Sage in the unflattering outfit, but not in the 500 dresses/shirts/pants/skirts that made her look stunning. Anna wasn't an idiot. Charles hadn't replied to any of them. He must be out doing something. Bran liked to steal him to go hunting when Anna was gone. She got a text back this time.
No idea. Da doesn't talk about it. But he doesn't talk about the past in general. Sorry for not responding earlier. Went for a run with Da.
Leia was humming again. Hearing it afresh, she could imagine it played by a full orchestra, with timpani drums beating the same rhythm of Leia's toes, making Anna's chest buzz with the power of it. Anna looked up from her phone and frowned at Leia. Understanding what a piece would sound like with different instrumentation was part of what had made Anna the kind of musician who got scholarships to Northwestern University. But this was more visceral than what she normally experienced. She needed to interrupt it, so she said, "What is that song, Leia?" "Rachel's right. It's familiar, but I can't place it." It made her want to go do something. Leia stopped humming, but she looked lost in her own thoughts. "Anna was a music major in college," Sage told Rachel, "before the bad wolves got her." Pulled away from the musical puzzle by Sage's words, Anna tried not to scowl. Anna hadn't wanted to go into graphic detail about her time in hell, for sure, so why did Sage, reducing her abduction to the level of a Grimm's fairy tale, make the hair on her neck stand up? Anna frowned at her mostly full cocktail. Sure, she was overreacting. Maybe she shouldn't drink things that tasted like paint thinner. Leia touched Anna's hand and gave her a soft smile that made her look more beautiful than Sage for a moment. And no one was more beautiful than Sage. It wasn't a smile Anna had ever seen on Leia's face before. Something, she thought, the music had brought out.
"I don't know the name of the song," Leia said, her voice a little rough, as if her throat were dry.
She looked at the far wall, but Anna was pretty sure it wasn't what she was seeing.
"I never did, or at least I don't think I did. It's been troubling me lately. I wonder what it means."
The waiter came back with their drinks then, and the topic of conversation moved on to something lighter. But the song Leia had hummed lingered in Anna's ears, along with a nagging sense of unease because of the unfinished story. It felt important. There had been 5 years between the day someone had happened upon Leia's starving family and when Bran and someone else had rescued her. Rescued her from what?
Chapter 1. Autumn, Aspen Creek, Montana. Anna let her hands press the ivory keys of the old upright piano in a few preparatory chords, enjoying the rich sound. Music for her was not just an auditory experience. She loved the feel of the vibrations running through her fingers. The bass notes resonated in her core, leaving her energized and ready to play, in all senses of the word. She glanced over her shoulder and up at her husband's face. She wasn't sure anyone else had ever played with him. No one in their pack, for certain, including Bran. Oh, they played music with him. But they didn't play games. The piano wasn't her instrument. But like most people who had ever attended college with the aim of majoring in music,
she was reasonably competent. For this game, the piano was more flexible than her preferred cello, which was limited to two notes at a time, a few more with harmonics. "Ready?" she asked him, then launched into the song without waiting for his response. She hummed where the melody came in. It was his job to figure out the words. It didn't take him long this time. Charles, his warmth against her back, though he didn't touch her, began singing the lyrics to Walk on the Ocean with her two beats after she'd started humming. The game had originated when Anna found out Charles hadn't heard of PDQ Bach, who had been a favorite of her music teacher's, a lack she had remedied with the help of the internet. In return, Charles had shared a few singers he liked. Some of them left her cold. Some of them had been unexpectedly awesome. Of course, she had heard Johnny Cash before she'd met Charles, but Charles had turned her into an unabashed Johnny Cash fan. Though she liked Cash's songs even better if Charles sang them. They suited his voice. She would have loved Charles if he hadn't been able to carry a tune in a bucket, but Charles's facility for and love of music had been one of the many unexpected gifts her mate had brought to their union. She had been so lucky to find him. Gradually, they had begun challenging each other, finding singers, groups, or songs that the other didn't know. It was the best kind of game, one with no losers. Either they figured out the song the other pulled out of their store of obscure or favorite songs, or obscure and favorite songs, or they didn't. Sometimes they kept score, the loser to do dishes or cook or something more fun. But mostly they just enjoyed making music together, the game giving the activity more variety than it might otherwise have had. Toad the Wet Sprocket, evidently, had not been a challenge at all. Anna laughed in surrender, then sang the rest of Walk on the Ocean with Charles, letting him anchor the melody while she worked out a descant an octave above him, pushing her alto into a register mostly reserved for sopranos. Sometimes crafting harmonies on the fly could go terribly wrong, but this time it sounded good. Their voices complemented each other, which even with good singers wasn't always true.
"That's one of Samuel's favorites," Charles said when they were finished.
Anna hadn't spent much time with Charles's brother. He'd left his father's pack by the time she joined, but she knew he was a musician too. Listening to Charles, Samuel, and their father perform the old Shaker song Simple Gifts at a funeral had been the first indication Anna had that she'd married into a very musical family. She'd thought her music lost the night she'd been attacked and turned into a werewolf. Charles had given it back. In return, she hoped, she had given him playfulness. He bent down, put his mouth against her ear, and said in a mock villain growl,
"You'll have to do better than that to defeat me."
The rumble of his voice sent chills up her spine. She loved it when he was happy. She was so easy, at least as far as Charles was concerned. She leaned back against him, then tilted her head up. He bent over and kissed her lips. He started to pull away, hesitated, and came down for a second round. His lips were softer than they looked, sweeping in from the corner of her mouth in a gentle caress before pressing her lips open. His breath became ragged. His muscles, still warming her back, tightened until she might have been leaning against a wall instead of a living being. If there was anything sexier than being desired, she didn't know what it could be. Her body became liquid as their lips lingered together, taking the gift of desire and returning it to him. His hand pressed briefly on her breastbone just above her breast, his touch gentle. Then he slid his hand up until it covered the arch of her throat, fingertips spread to span her jawline, encouraging her to keep her head tilted for his kiss.
As if she needed encouragement.
When he finished with her mouth for the moment, his lips brushed her cheekbone and over to her ear, which he nipped. The sharpness, after the soft and light touch, sent a shock reverberating up her spine. She said. He stepped away from her, breathing hard. His smile was sheepish.
That was a little more than I intended, he said.
She shrugged, knowing the dismissive gesture would be given the lie by her reddened lips, and the arousal he probably would not have to be a werewolf to sense.
I am not taking any of the fault for that, sir.
He laughed, the sound low and soft, hot.
But he still took another step away, backward, as if he couldn't quite make himself turn his back on her.
I have a song for you, he said. I've been working on this for a while.
He grabbed one of the cases stacked along the wall of their music room and took out a flute. He gave Anna an assessing look, and then pulled her guitar off the wall where it hung with several of his. She had come to him with nothing, but she had the feeling, given the pleasure he took in giving her things, that her collection of instruments might outpace his in time. She took the guitar when he handed it to her.
Just what am I supposed to do with this?
She asked archly, but she reversed her position on the piano bench, so the piano was at her back, and gave the guitar strings an experimental strum, adjusting the high E until the pitch was true. They were new strings, and the E liked to slip. He didn't answer her, just pulled up a chair so he would face her when he sat in it. He dragged a low table over beside his chair and set the flute on it. Then he searched the cases and pulled out an instrument she hadn't seen him use. A viola.
Ooh,
she said. Can I see? He raised an eyebrow, but handed it over.
It's Da's,
he told her. She glanced in the F-hole and found a marker's ink signature and the date 1872. It didn't tell her much. She reached out blindly, and he gave her the bow. She tested it, tightened the peg an eighth of a turn, and stroked the bow across the strings, smiling at the rich tone.
Bran has good taste, she said,
handing the viola and bow back to him. He took more care tuning it than she had with the guitar, as one does, she thought, with amusement. Violas, like their little sister, the violin, were temperamental. When he was satisfied, he sat down, the viola held like a cello, instead of the more usual under-the-chin method.
Ready?
He asked. She rolled her eyes. No, what are we playing? Or do I get to make something up? How about a key signature? He grinned.
I have faith.
Join in when you are ready. He picked up the flute, and he was right. She recognized the tune. She'd been making an effort at reconnecting with a few of her friends from Northwestern. A few months ago, one of them had shared a link to a self-proclaimed Mongolian folk metal band. They called themselves The Who. They played modified traditional Mongolian instruments in addition to those more commonly found in rock bands. They also used a type of throat singing in which a single singer produced more than one note at the same time. They sounded exactly like what she'd have expected musicians from Genghis Khan's troops to sound like if they'd been given the power of modern instruments. She loved it. She'd shared their music with Charles. He'd listened to a couple of songs, nodded his head, and she'd thought that had been that.
Apparently, she'd been wrong.
He began, as the original song did, with the flute, switching seamlessly to the viola, which he used to mimic the traditional horsehead fiddle. When he sang, he used the throat singing technique in, as far as she could tell, the original Mongolian. It was a gift. He'd done a great deal of work, and he was a busy man, to prepare this song for her. For a quiet man, Charles was very good at saying, I love you. When the song drew to an end, Anna, flushed with enjoyment and pleasure, applauded enthusiastically. Holy cow, just, wow, I didn't know you speak Mongolian. You are full of surprises. He put the viola away
and gave her a lighthearted grin that lit up his face.
I just mimic. Doubtless my song would leave anyone who actually spoke Mongolian scratching their head. And I don't have the throat singing down right. There's a vibration technique I haven't figured out yet. I had to do that on the viola.
Anna hung her guitar up, shaking her head with mock reproof. That's it. You might as well give up music altogether and go live on the top of a mountain where you can wallow in your shame.
Big arms wrapped around her, pulling her back against him. She gave an exaggerated oof, as if he'd squeezed out all of her air.
Only if you come with me, he crooned. Then I won't get bored as I wallow.
What makes you think I could help you with boredom? She asked in an innocent voice, pushing her hips back against him suggestively as one of his hands moved down an iron bar across her belly while the other moved up, pushing her hair aside to bare the side of her throat for him.
What is it you think we can do all alone?
Upstairs, the doorbell rang. They both froze. It was late for casual visitors.
The door isn't locked, Charles growled.
And anyone who is pack is likely to just walk in, she agreed reluctantly. He didn't release her.
Charles? She asked.
He inhaled her scent.
I am second in the pack, he said with obvious reluctance. If someone is ringing our doorbell, I have to answer.
She twisted in his arms and stood on tiptoe to kiss his chin, liking that she was going to smell like him for a while. Geez, being a werewolf had changed her point of view on a lot of things, she mused, turning to climb up the stairs, Charles at her heels.
The phone rang, the landline that never rang, but hung from the wall above the light switch like a tribute to the past. Charles stopped, decided.
It's Da, he told her, then answered the phone.
Bran could make his voice heard in the minds of his wolves, and probably anyone else he cared to. He maintained that he could not hear responses, which was, Anna assumed, why he had decided to use the phone.
Tell Anna to get the door, Bran said. You need to let the wolf greet them.
And then he left them, with a dial tone.
Huh, she thought, meeting Charles's eyes.
He shrugged. He didn't know why Bran had bothered calling, either. Maybe just to make whoever was at the door wait a bit longer. Trying to work out the hows and whys of Bran's actions tended to leave Anna with a headache, and no wiser for the struggle. Anna obeyed her orders, walking the 12 feet or so to the door and opening it. She was still trying to work out what Bran's call had been about, so she blinked a little at the unexpected visitors. The nearest, illuminated by the porch light, was a 40-something black woman, looking athletic and smart in a white polo shirt with the FBI logo on one shoulder and dark blue trousers. Beside her was a short, fine-boned white man who could have been anywhere from his mid-50s to mid-70s. His hair, which had been dark, had been shaved completely off. His tan jacket and blue slacks fit him well and were free of wrinkles or creases. Still, he struck her as more fragile than he'd been the last time she'd seen him, and she wondered if he had been sick. He didn't smell sick. For a moment, she felt an automatic smile of welcome flow up toward her face, born of a genuine liking for Special Agent Leslie Fisher, and a generally favorable impression of Special Agent Craig Goldstein. But they weren't supposed to know who she was now, or where she and Charles lived. A wide streak of wariness shoved her smile aside as she contemplated the two FBI agents and wondered what this visit was about to change in their world. This is unexpected, she said. As the daughter of a lawyer, Anna had a natural inclination to respect the law, but the FBI had no real jurisdiction over her. They would not be permitted to question her or arrest her or take her to trial without a great deal of trouble. Maybe not even then. They were all on pack territory now. She wondered if they understood just how dangerous that was for them. She certainly understood how dangerous their presence here was for the werewolves. This was above her pay grade, she thought. But it would not help matters
to let Charles take over. Leslie looked at Goldstein. Anna remembered that he'd been the senior of the two when she'd first met them. It seemed that still held true.
"We have some information for you, Miss Smith," he said without apology. "We felt it was best delivered in person. We also felt that you were the best person to deliver it to."
Goldstein knew very well Smith wasn't her name. Anna didn't like him rubbing her nose in it. She and Charles had made it plain that Smith had been a nom de nécessité and not their own. For heaven's sake, why else would they have used Smith, notorious in fact and fiction, as a false name? Goldstein's words smacked of a power play, and Anna disliked politics intensely. Too bad her mate was only slightly more inclined to diplomacy than certain axe-wielding Vikings of her acquaintance, which left the role of negotiator to her. This, she thought ruefully, was bound to be a disaster. Several years of being trapped in a pack where brutality was a fact of everyday life had given her some skills in negotiating with terrorists, however. She wasn't quite ready to put Leslie Fisher in that category, but it was probably best to assume the worst. First, show no fear. This was much easier to manage with Charles waiting behind her than it had been when she'd been alone, especially since the FBI had sent people she knew and liked. This was probably not a hostile move on their part. Not yet, anyway. "My name," Anna said, letting ice coat her voice, "is Anna Cornick." Since they were standing on her porch, they already knew her real name. "Second, give the appearance of cooperation, but don't give them anything. You don't have to."
"He was trying to be tactful," Leslie said, though she didn't believe it. Anna raised an eyebrow. "Werewolves can smell lies."
This was something like her name that they also already knew. Leslie flinched subtly and gave her cohort a grim look. The next sentence out of her mouth was the truth, and she sounded more like a professional agent than a friend.
"I'm sorry for the surprise, but we do need to talk to you. Rather than advertising that the FBI came to call on you, can we come in?"
Anna crossed her arms over her chest and snorted. "This is a small town. Everyone already knows you're here. Sometime in the next 10 minutes, they'll look up your plates."
"It's a rental car."
Challenge accepted, Anna thought. Helen Oxford has a sister who works in the airport in Missoula with the rental car agencies. She won't have any trouble finding out who rented the car.
"We drove in from Spokane, not Missoula," said Leslie.
"Rental car agencies are nationwide companies," Goldstein remarked to no one in particular. Then he said, "Point taken, Ms. Cornick. If you wish to discuss this on your doorstep," he looked around.
They were surrounded by mountains and forest. There were no nearby houses. The closest neighbor was a half mile away.
"Then I see no reason we cannot do that." "Invite them in," said Brother Wolf.
Anna glanced over her shoulder to see the Red Wolf standing in most of the available floor of their gallery kitchen. She wondered again why Bran had decided to give the FBI a werewolf to look at. It was not a bad idea to remind your enemy of who you are, she supposed, though she hadn't thought the FBI were their enemies. She had considered Leslie a friend, but she couldn't afford them to be friends now.
"We have two items of business to bring before you today," Goldstein was saying. "We know some things we think you should know, and we'd like to start building toward a more formal relationship that could help us both."
Brother Wolf had said to let them in, but Anna wasn't sure it was a good idea. She was reasonably certain that Charles wouldn't tear into the FBI agents without violent provocation, and she was reasonably certain, having dealt with both agents in the past, that neither of them was likely to be violently provocative. But Brother Wolf was an entirely different kettle of fish.
"We'll behave,"
Brother Wolf assured her.
"You can let them in."
"I see," said Anna. "Perhaps you should come in." She stepped back, opening the door as an invitation. The open door also gave them a very good view of Brother Wolf. If the sight of the werewolf bothered them, neither of them let it show. They had met Charles's wolf before. Anna waved a hand, directing the agents through the living room and into the dining area beyond. Leslie let Agent Goldstein take the lead, and Anna followed behind them. Leslie paused, looking at the large painting hung over the fireplace. Other than the various instruments that were scattered about, it was the only piece of art in the room. It was a new painting, still smelling of oils to Anna's sensitive nose. The smaller piece it replaced had been moved to their bedroom, both works by the same artist. On one level, the painting was of a gray wolf, not a werewolf, standing in winter woods. But that wasn't the lingering impression it made. Whenever Anna looked at it, she could feel the tension drain away and optimism flood in to replace it. Anna had stared at the painting for hours, and she still didn't know how Wellesley had done it. Wellesley's work had always been spectacular, but this one, painted after his curse had been removed, was more something. Asil had brought it over after Wellesley had left. It had come with a note that read, "For Anna." He hadn't signed either the note or the painting. "Beautiful piece," Leslie said, reaching out but not touching the canvas. "Who's the artist?" "A friend," answered Anna. She had no idea if Wellesley would be interested in painting as a career again or what name he would choose when and if he did, but she did think if he had wanted people to know who had painted it, he would have signed it. If she and Leslie were being friendly, she might have told her so. As it was, the words lingered in the air. Leslie frowned at Anna, but continued on to the dining room to sit beside Goldstein. Once she was seated, she glanced over her shoulder at the painting again. Anna pulled up a seat opposite the two agents. Charles moved to her side and stared at them. Neither agent stared back at him, which was smart of them. Charles was not happy. "We are," Anna began softly, "very interested in who told you where we live." Goldstein nodded and put his briefcase, a battered leather case that had seen better days, on the table and opened it. He pulled out a thick file in a folder and held it out to Anna. Taped to the front of the folder was a thumb drive. When she didn't take it, he set it on the table between them. "Most of what we know about werewolves has been gathered in bits and pieces for decades, if not longer." Goldstein's voice had a faint New York accent Anna hadn't caught before. "A slip here, a note there. A colleague of mine has been riding a hobby horse of werewolf lore for the entirety of his 40-year career at the Bureau. You'll find most of the general information comes to us from the armed forces. Apparently, there have been a great many werewolves over the years who have served their country." He pulled another file out with another thumb drive. "This is from the Cantrip archives." He didn't say how they'd gotten it. "Cantrip has been fed information about you from various groups, some of them supernatural hate groups like Bright Future or the John Lawrence Society. Some of them are other supernatural groups. One informant was a witch, and she provided them with the equivalent of a biology textbook. Her information was classified, and only the very top echelon of Cantrip has access to it. There was a vampire, too, at some point, but he killed two of their agents, and they killed him." Leslie cleared her throat. "There is information in there you would not want to be public knowledge." Anna didn't make any move to take the offerings on the table. That would be for someone else to go through. Goldstein did not say who had told them where Anna and Charles lived, which would have been more interesting information. Charles had long ago hacked into the Cantrip database. He probably had hacked into the FBI files, too. The wolves knew there were people in the government who understood what the wolves were and mostly who they were. It was not the government Bran was worried about. At least, not yet. It was the public in general, and what the public would urge their government to do. "You've obviously had this information for a while," she said. "So why the candor now? What do you mean to accomplish with this?" She waved her hand at the files on the table. Goldstein smiled grimly.
Some of my superiors were quite stuck on Hauptmann. It took some persuading to bring this here instead. Anna didn't know what kind of reaction she was supposed to have, since the Columbia Basin pack and Adam Hauptmann, its prickly and extremely handsome alpha, were the most famous werewolves on the planet, at least in the eyes of the purely human. "Okay," she said. Leslie's face didn't change, but from Goldstein's expression, Anna knew her response hadn't been the one he was looking for. "The FBI feels that the various supernatural groups pose a threat to the public. We are reasonably certain if all hell breaks loose, our superior numbers and weapons will leave us the last one standing. But that only means we all lose." "Yes," Anna agreed, having heard variants on this assessment, albeit from the werewolf side, for years. "We feel with allies to lend us knowledge, finesse, and firepower, we could avoid the zero-sum ending. We need a large group, one we can trust, and who can trust us?" Anna must have made some sort of derisive sound, because Goldstein grinned appreciatively. "For some levels of trust," he agreed. "The FBI is a large organization, and our upper management is politically appointed. We have not involved the political appointees at this point. We do understand why you might be less than happy to ally yourselves with us. That's why I brought you our files, as a gesture of goodwill."
"Not much of a risk," Anna observed, "since it's all information about werewolves. And we already know all about werewolves."
"Right," said Goldstein. "But you can find out how much we know about you."
Anna wasn't sure she believed that last part, even if Goldstein did, but she didn't think that conversation would be useful. She shrugged.
"All right. So why bring it to us?"
Goldstein frowned at her a moment. He tapped a finger on the table and said,
"I think our opportunity to ally with the Fey died when that thrice-be-damned court let Hoyter walk. Everyone in the courtroom, judge and jury, knew he'd raped and killed people who came from the supernatural groups. Everyone knew he'd raped the daughter of a Grey Lord and intended to kill her. And they still let him off, because he was human, and his victims were not. Do you remember the cheers from the courtroom?"
They had all been there.
His assessment of that situation was right on target, Anna thought. Gwyn Ochlu, who went by the name of Beauclair, was the most prominent member of the faction of Grey Lords who had been friendly toward humans. It had been his daughter who had been brutalized and scarred. "Charles told me the world would have been better off if he'd just killed Hoyter when he had a chance," Anna agreed. "It wouldn't have been just to kill a man who had surrendered. But what the courts delivered wasn't justice either."
"I could have shot him too," Leslie observed, regretfully. "I thought about it pretty hard."
Goldstein grunted. "That ship has sailed. So while we hope for a ceasefire with the Fey, we are aware the Fey will never trust us. My bones will be dust and Beauclair will still remember a human court chose to protect their own monster rather than give a Grey Lord's daughter justice."
"That is a problem when dealing with immortal creatures," murmured Anna.
"The only other large and organized group we know about is the vampires. It is difficult for a chicken to make an alliance with a fox. You never know when you'll be eaten for breakfast," Goldstein said.
And the vampires were still allowing the world to pretend they didn't exist. It was easier for everyone concerned. An alliance would surely mean the vampires had to come out of the shadows.
"That left the werewolves," Leslie said.
"But we didn't know how to approach it. We knew there were packs directed by alphas. We even knew several of the alphas very well. Hauptmann, for instance. Then you and Charles came to Boston."
They hadn't mentioned the witches, Anna noted. Maybe they didn't consider them an organized group.
"Before that," said Goldstein, "we had always thought the wolves to be individual packs run by unaffiliated alphas. As soon as we reconsidered, it wasn't hard to look at certain events and see the wolves are highly organized.
that they are able to act as a single unit if necessary.
Anna controlled a snort. He made it sound like a business arrangement. Bran controlling the werewolves was more like shoving tigers around with cattle prods, marginally effective, if potentially fatal to all involved.
Is that person, the person in charge, is that you, Anna Kornick? Asked Goldstein.
She'd been stuck trying to make her tiger metaphor work. She had to blink at Goldstein for a minute to process what he'd said. She decided that was a good thing, because it wasn't hard to keep her face blank while she thought about what to do with his question. Why do you ask? She said, without letting any expression enter her voice or face. Her years surviving in a brutal pack had given her that ability.
You know who I am. Anna Latham, age 26, college dropout. Anna Latham, musical prodigy, said Goldstein somberly, who disappeared after work one night and was never seen again. Oh, her father and brother both say that she is alive, but no one else who knew her has heard from her. No concerts have been scheduled, though she used to do them as an invited guest.
She'd been working and reconnecting with her friends. Either the FBI had asked the wrong people, or her friends thought she was in trouble and were trying to protect her. The concerts, though, were unlikely to happen. She missed performing to a big crowd.
Werewolves are immortal, said Leslie, very quietly.
And Anna remembered how worried Leslie had been when she'd first met Anna, that someone as young as Anna had been married to Charles, who did not look young, no matter the lack of wrinkles or gray hair.
No one with eyes as old as his could look young. Isaac, the alpha of the Boston pack, began Goldstein.
Old Town pack, Anna corrected.
Old Town pack, Goldstein repeated,
and she bet he wouldn't get it wrong again.
Isaac had no trouble following your orders.
That they had seen, anyway. I thought at first you were playing front man to Charles, Leslie said. But he does your bidding, too. And they had added 2 and 2, and come up with 22. Anna opened her mouth to tell them they were wrong.
Wait. See what they have to say. Do not lie to them. That could come back and bite us. But for now, let them believe you were leading the packs.
It was Bran's voice in her head.
Ah.
That was why Charles had had her invite the FBI in, so his Da could listen from outside the house. It had taken her a long time to adjust to the difficulty of a private conversation with other werewolves around. The walls of her house were no match for wolf ears. I see, Anna said, because she had been ready to tell them they were wrong, and she couldn't think of anything else to say.
If there is someone in charge, if that is you, we, that is to say, my,
Goldstein faltered.
Superiors? Suggested Anna. Owners, growled Brother Wolf, unhappy with Bran for asking his mate to put herself in harm's way like this.
Colleagues, said Leslie, watching Goldstein.
Equals.
Goldstein had been with the Bureau for more than 20 years, Anna recalled. He wasn't subject to political whim because he wasn't quite that far up in the bureaucracy. But Charles had told her Goldstein was right on the edge. He could have toppled into high office had he wished it. Leslie Fisher was on her way to do exactly that. Our job, Leslie said intensely, the job of the FBI is to protect the citizens of the United States. We can do that better through an alliance with the werewolves. Who are citizens of the United States, said Anna.
Yes, agreed Goldstein, after a damning hesitation. An alliance between the FBI and the werewolves will make everyone safer.
Anna wondered if that was true. We know an alliance will take time, Leslie said. But today is a start. Goldstein pulled out another folder and set it beside the other two.
To that end, as a demonstration that you might find us as useful to you as you are to us, we have a mystery for you.
There's a town missing, said Leslie, pulling a folded-up USGS map out of the folder and laying it on the table. Someone had used a black marker to circle an area, then taped a slip of white paper next to the circle, written in a neat hand in blue ink with the words, Wild Sign. Leslie tapped the marked space. A group of people, as few as 30 or as many as 40 as best we can tell, went up into the Marble Mountains in Northern California to live off-grid. The first of them set up about 2 or 3 years ago. Their settlement was illegal. The mountains are a mix of designated wilderness, federal lands, and tribal lands. Probably, they thought they were on federal lands.
Lots of snow in the marbles,
Brother Wolf told her, and Anna got something that was very nearly a visual from him. We have confirmation it was an active site this spring, when one of the Forest Service Rangers stopped in to check on them. One of the community wrote to his daughter and gave her this map. It was his habit to write her regularly, but his last letter was this April, a few days after the ranger stopped by, in fact. When the daughter received no further correspondence, she hiked in and found it abandoned. They were just gone. Like Roanoke, said Goldstein. They just all disappeared. Of the names we've found, none of them have relocated, and none of their relatives know where they are.
And this concerns us how? Anna asked.
Because it was finally determined that the settlement is not on either federal or tribal lands. It's on a private parcel, owned by Aspen Creek, Inc., said Goldstein.
Which is why no one tried to move them along.
He and Leslie were looking at Anna, and she had no trouble looking blank. Aspen Creek, Inc. was the owner of the condo you stayed in while you were in Boston, Leslie said. And Aspen Creek is where you live, where your pack lives, she hesitated. Where the Merrocks pack lives. The title Merrock was not a secret word, but it was one Anna had never heard from a government official before. Leslie's tone of voice and her pause meant she knew how important that term was. Anna didn't know what Brand wanted to do about his title being bandied about in the human halls of power, so she chose to do nothing. After it became obvious Anna wasn't going to admit to anything, Goldstein's voice was dry when he continued.
And there is this.
The original owner of the property was one Leah Fenwood Cornick. A light knock sounded, and the front door opened. Bran came in with a sheepish smile on his face. Anna had heard Charles's foster sister, Mercy, say Bran looked more like a pizza delivery boy than the wolf who rules. She hadn't quite understood it until just that minute. He wore a long-sleeve shirt that managed to conceal the hardness of his body, his shoulders hunched vaguely apologetically to match his smile. With a height that was just barely average and sandy blonde hair worn a little untidily, Bran looked like a college student or a pizza delivery boy.
Hi,
he said pleasantly to the FBI agents without quite meeting their eyes. He patted Charles on the head as he padded around to slip between his son and Anna.
May I?
He inquired of Anna as he pulled the map over toward their side of the table.
Be my guest, she said, unable to quite conceal her amusement.
He bent over the map. After a brief but thorough examination, during which Anna returned Leslie's inquiring look with a shrug, Bran gave an abrupt nod of his head. He looked his son in the eye for a moment, tapped the table with one brisk finger, then exited the house with a wave over his shoulder that might have been directed at the FBI agents or the room in general.
They feel earnest,
Bran told her after he'd shut the door behind him.
They at least believe everything they're saying. Tell them who I am. Tell them we will go looking. Tell them the rest of their visit might or might not be fruitful. The lessons Beauclair learned are lessons we also take to heart. It might have been one of ours in the courtroom instead of Lizzie Beauclair. I did not trust the humans.
Anna drew in a deep breath. Despite your flattering suspicions, I am not the wolf who rules. She liked Mercy's phrase for Bran's title. Narok didn't mean much to humans until she explained it. Wolf who rules was self-explanatory. The wolf who rules just left, through the front door. He believes you were sincere, but the lesson Beauclair received, the lesson we all received about how humans really think of us, is concerning. You might not think we are monsters, or at least that we can be your monsters. But we don't believe the rest of the citizens of this country agree. That doesn't mean cooperation is out of the question, or that we won't be available to give a certain amount of aid. But don't consider us allies yet. You can't mean to tell us he is the wolf in charge. Goldstein's voice conveyed absolute disbelief. I have met Hauptmann. Hauptmann would never take orders from someone like him. But they would take orders from someone like me? Asked Anna, amused. They do take orders from you. I've seen it, he said, as emotional as Anna had ever heard him. Anna smiled. I was Anna Latham, the music student at Northwestern. I am 26 years old. I am married to the son of the Merrock. The Merrock, who just left. She let the smile fall from her face, because this was important. She liked both FBI agents and didn't want either of them to do something dangerously stupid, like underestimating Bran. He is very good at blending in, my father-in-law. But don't mistake him for anything but a ruthless bastard. Charles smiled, showing all of his teeth. Charles showered first, then dressed while Anna showered. He wasn't sure he wanted to go running in the mountains of California on a wild goose chase. Brother Wolf, however, was eager. It had been a long time since they had hunted in those mountains. Werewolves tended to be territorial, and Brother Wolf was no exception, but he loved to go exploring, too, and he wanted to share all of the extraordinary places they had been with Anna.
There was a cave, he told Charles. Do you remember the cave?
Charles did.
The marbles encompass a lot of ground, he told Brother Wolf. He wasn't sure the wolf could read maps. That cave is maybe 20 miles from where we're headed.
He considered.
We might manage the lake with the big trout, though, if it's still there.
The Klamath River, like most big rivers, had been dammed, and its path forever changed. New lakes formed, and others gone forever.
Anna came into the bedroom with a big red towel wrapped around herself and nothing else. Her reddish-brown hair was tied up on top of her head, and there was a drop of water on his favorite freckle. They were all his favorite freckles.
Stop that, you, she said. But he could tell she didn't really mean it by the heat in her eyes. We have bigger problems. What was your dad thinking, strolling in there like some meek little lamb? I don't know if I managed to convince the FBI that he's the Merrock.
That isn't urgent, Charles said. He can convince them himself whenever he wants to. He came in to see the map. I think he knows something about what's happened, and he came in to see if he needed to kill someone. It's a good thing the FBI sent Fisher and Goldstein. If they had sent someone more twisty, Da might have decided to kill them to send a message to their owners. He used the term Brother Wolf had thrown out. Anna grimaced.
I thought that might be it. She looked at Charles.
I would have defended them. He knew that, and it would have been obvious to his Da as well. That knowledge might have been the thing keeping both agents alive. He didn't think it was, because Bran was seriously considering alliance.
Unofficial offers from government officials are notoriously dangerous, he observed. Secret alliances were the powder keg that blew up into World War I.
That doesn't mean friendly relations wouldn't be useful, Anna countered. He nodded agreement.
Friendly, yes. But wherever such a relationship ends up, it will be far short of an us-against-them alliance of humans and werewolves against all comers.
Especially since Bran doesn't really like mundane humans, added Anna, wiping her cheek on the end of her towel. Charles closed the distance between them. He put a finger over the towel where her breasts came together and formed a valley, but he left the towel where it was. He never touched her without her consent, and never would. She smiled, and it was a wicked, hungry thing.
Yes,
she said.